Welcome, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. I'm so glad you could be with us because, really, you had no choice. You're stuck in your house, at least if you're smart, safe people, you're stuck in your house, unlike some dumbass people out there with no okay, I digress. I got in that too early. I'm not going there now. But anyway, I'm glad you are with me today. I've got I'm at this point in this relationship. I don't know how he feels, but I'm at this point in this relationship where I can refer to him as dear friend. Yeah, you know.
Oh, totally.
Brothers don't typically go there that early. You know, it takes sometimes maybe some Cavassier and, you know, but.
Please.
We got there quick.
Come on. We've traveled internationally together. Our spouses are friends.
Yes, yes. This is all good. Jonathan Capehart, he is the Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, member of the Washington Post editorial board, an opinion writer focusing on the intersection of social and cultural issues and politics, host of a great podcast, which I've had the luxury, because it is a luxury for me, to have appeared the number of times I have. I think it's six now.
You have the most by far.
This is what you call makeup podcasting here, because I owe the brother some time. But he is the host of the K-pop podcast. He's also an MSNBC contributor, where we are colleagues together. He serves as a substitute anchor and has served as a guest host on Midday in WNYC on New York Public Radio. He was the deputy editorial page editor of the New York Daily News from 2002 and 2000 to 2004. That's how it all began for you, isn't it, Jonathan?
It goes even further back because I'm old.
You are. You are a young-looking old black man.
You know what they say, BDC.
Yeah, it doesn't, right?
Nope.
I get that all the time. How old do you think I am? Oh, you're probably about 45. Baby, come on home with me. No, I'm not 45. But yeah, but you've been in this game a while. And I wanted to go start with your roots to get into some really, I want to have a barbershop conversation about some shit that's just on the street right now that we just got to get out there and deal with. And I think you're going to be good to talk about that because you've covered these storylines from George Floyd and others for a long, long time. So people understand this journalism thing isn't like, you know, you didn't wake up and want a Pulitzer. You put in some time, right?
Right. Yep. My first job, well, you can go all the way back to my first internship on the Today Show at NBC in the summers of 86 and 87. And then working as a temp at NBC during all my breaks from college, my first job, real job in journalism was as a vacation relief researcher on the Today Show.
Those are always fun jobs, right?
Yeah, because, you know, I left a full-time job with benefits to take a big leap of faith for a guarantee of just 3 months, no health insurance, lateral move in terms of salary because there was going to be a ton of overtime, and that was to do that for the Today Show. And I took that leap of faith, one, because I knew a lot of the people there, but also I just had enough faith in my abilities that 3 months would be extended. And sure enough, the only reason why I left the Today Show in 1993 was because the Daily News editorial page sent out a bat signal looking for young people who could write for the editorial page. And I was 25.
Wow. I
think I was 25 years old.
Wow. Yeah, but you had game at 25. You clearly, no, you had.
I'd like
come
to
on.
Think so.
Well, I mean, think about it, though. I mean, just in terms of where you wound up actually serving on the editorial board of the New York Daily News, right? For 7 years.
Well, a total of nine, because I was there for seven from 93 to 2000, and we won the Pulitzer in 99. And then I left because I thought, okay, I've got journalism's biggest prize. I should go national. So I went to Bloomberg News.
You can't do that, you black.
Well, look, I went to Bloomberg News.
Yeah.
And I went to Bloomberg News where they tripled my salary and told me to write once a week and go wherever I needed to go to cover the story.
Oh, you were like, okay, I can do that.
It was one of the best jobs in journalism that I have ever had.
So why'd you leave?
Because Mike Bloomberg decided to run for mayor and asked me to be a policy advisor. And as a person who covered politics and covered campaigns from afar, the prospect of working on an actual campaign was just, and the campaign of someone I knew and believed in,
right,
was too good to pass up.
Imagine,
and also, it wasn't your regular your traditional campaign. It was self-financed. I still was able to go to, you know, our group beach house weekends during that mayoral campaign.
But imagine how different your life would have turned out if you said, no, I really like what I do. I'm going to stay.
True. Then, who knows where it could have gone? I mean, I had good options either end.
Yeah. So with that backdrop, that storyline, I have no other way to put this. So you know me, I'm just going to put it as I feel it. There's some effed up shit going on right now in space with black folks. I sat at my desk the other night. I rewatched the death of George Floyd. And for those of you who don't know who he is, let me emblazon his name in your mind. He is the young black man who was killed by police in Minneapolis. 2 months ago now, right? And
It was two months ago.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I was confused.
Time is elapsing.
Time is elapsing. Right? Yeah.
It was just this Monday.
This past Monday. Now I was thinking about our brother who was jogging 2 months ago, 3 months ago, and was
Ahmaud Arbery.
Yes. And with the police knee in his neck screaming for his life, I can't breathe. And then you had, of course, Christopher Cooper, who's a young brother who's a bird watcher and, you know, outdoorsman who's in Central Park. And this young white woman who's out with her dog unleashed. And all the signs say your dog has to be leashed. And he says to her, ma'am, could you leash your dog? See, the sign says your dog has to be leashed. She goes off on him. And I'm going to call the police and tell them you're threatening me. What is it about some white folks that still have a problem with black people? I don't understand. I watched the Floyd video at my desk the other night. And I literally start to cry again because I'm thinking about all the young black men before him, men that you've covered in your writings for sure. I'm thinking about Mr. Arbery just a few months ago. And I'm thinking about my own sons who have to traverse this culture as young black men, trying to carve out their piece of whatever they define the American dream is for themselves. And they have this to deal with. They can't be black and follow the rules like Mr. Cooper. They can't be black and drink at a Starbucks. They can't be black and jog. They can't be black and fill in the blank. How hard has that been for you as someone who covers and writes about cultural issues and the intersection of politics and society? Do you have that moment where, unfortunately, I just slipped up and said something I shouldn't have said? And I do. I apologize to my audience for that because that was rude and crude. But that was an emotional response. And that's just how I feel this week. How do you write about that?
Well, the way I deal with it, it's now not how do I write about it, it's how do I deal with it. I have not watched the Arbery video in its entirety. At first, I resisted watching it because I long had grown tired of watching what I call black male murder porn.
Right.
I watched it, the little bit of it I did, in order to write a piece more truthfully from my spirit. I have not watched more than 5 seconds of the George Floyd video. Just seeing his head on the ground with that officer's knee on his neck and the passive look on that officer's face, mm-hmm. as if he's, you know, bending down to pick up a quarter. With his hands in his pocket. It's too much to bear. I said on our editorial board call after Arbery, I said, you know, I haven't watched the video for obvious reasons. A few years ago, here in Washington, there was a motorcycle being chased by the cops.
Mm-hmm.
The chase ended with the police firing upon the motorcyclist, and he went down at an intersection. I saw the news reports, saw the stories. My husband and I, you know, that next morning we went out to breakfast. I'm walking down the stairs of my apartment. Outside, I look to my left, and I see some police activity.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep walking. It wasn't until a local elected official sent me a message saying on Twitter, a DM saying, "Hey, this situation happened a block from your apartment. You've been so vocal on all these other shootings. Where are you on this?"
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it clicked. I had become so numb to watching black men being killed on video that I was completely blind to yet another shooting that happened a block away from my my apartment.
Yeah.
At a certain point, it becomes a matter of self-care. For anyone who's listening, who's, you know, thinking, "Oh, what a snowflake. Oh, what a this, what a that." You try watching someone who looks like you, someone with whom you have an affinity, someone in your family. You try watching them being abused in one way or another over and over and over again, one. And then watch the people who have done the abusing not be held accountable. And you watch that over and over again, and it starts to wear on you just in terms of your own psyche. The other thing that happens, and I'm just speaking personally, is that you start to feel the walls closing in. Back then, it was, you know, police getting involved and people getting hurt and or killed.
Right.
But then the conversation moved into Permit Patty and Barbecue Becky,
mm-hmm.
and all where every we you and I have long known that just everyday blackness can get you into some kind of jam.
It can get you jacked up, baby. That's all
but
I know.
But now we're watching it. Now, thanks to camera phones, this is the double-edged sword here. It's painful to watch, but thank God there's evidence. We have now seen, and we now have a list, barbecuing while black, staying at an Airbnb while black,
yeah.
sitting in your own home watching television and someone bursts into your apartment while black,
yeah.
birding while black, studying at an Ivy League university
while
black.
I mean, yep. Yep.
There are so many, jogging while black. I'm someone who goes out and does long walks and runs, but there's
reason.
Well, I used to.
Okay.
I've gotten to that age where now it's just brisk.
It's
walking.
A brisk walking.
Brisk walking, but you know, there's a reason why I don't do a lot of walking in residential neighborhoods. I head down to the mall. I head down to the National Mall. I head down to the walkways and the pathways that are very wide open. and spacious. Just one, because it's beautiful, but also it's just one less thing I have to worry about in terms of someone thinking I'm suspicious. Heaven forbid I walk by a beautiful house with a beautiful lawn and admiring the architecture and someone called the cops thinking I'm quote-unquote casing the joint. These are the sorts of things that we have to deal with on a daily basis that take a psychic toll, an emotional toll. But in the job that I have to give myself the room to acknowledge those emotions, feel those emotions, and then write something that channels those emotions into words that not only speak for me, but speak for other people who either don't know how to express themselves or aren't expressing themselves in the way that they want to. You know, one of the most gratifying things about my job is when I write something that is like truly, I'm only writing it for me and I'm putting it out into the universe because I need to say it. And then to have someone, just one person, write back to me and say, thank you so much for what you wrote. You wrote what I've been thinking.
That's usually not me. I usually, when I write back, I'm like, what the hell are you doing? No. What is this? Stop it.
Right. You liberal.
No, but that's a good feeling, though. I mean, that's got to be, that's affirming. That's affirming because the one thing that I take from your writing, which is why I like it, you throw out tentacles and you look through your writing, and this is my interpretation, so forgive me, but if it's not correct,
I'll let you know.
I'll get back on the couch. and have my therapist work me through it. You put out tentacles looking for connections. And the thing that I like about your writing is that you're not looking for the perfect connection. You're looking, can you connect to this story in which it causes you to think about something, see something, understand it, appreciate it, and then react to it. You could, like you said, you know, someone will write back and say, oh yeah, this was, you know, you wrote what I've been feeling or something like that. And that's always good. But I've also, in following your Twitter feed and the comments in the Washington Post under your articles, you also elicit the, you know, some of it's trolling. We get that. So carve that crap out. But you also get people who, like, I don't necessarily see it that way. I think you're overlooking this. And for you, that's, you're okay with that because the connection's been made around the story. In other words, I now got you thinking about this young man named Floyd. I've got you thinking about this young man named Aubrey. I've got you thinking about, you know, these people whose lives you otherwise wouldn't know about, innocuous on a day-to-day basis, but for somehow, for some reason, and we know what that is, they've been thrust into this space in an unfortunate, ugly way. And you need to see this and reckon with it.
Right. And, you know, when I react to people, you know, sending out those tentacles and hoping people will respond and say, you know, oh, I didn't see it that way, or have you considered this? I don't write in order for people to agree with me 100%. Right. I write in order for people to understand what is happening from a 35,000 foot perspective. And if you have taken the time to not only read the headline, but to click the link and read the story and then come back at me with, I read it and here's my take, my job is done whether you agree with me or not. When Trayvon Martin was killed, I mean, that was the first time where I really put my my heart out there. And I, you know, wrote about this young person.
Yeah, you did. I remember that. Yeah.
Killed. And then I just, not as a throwaway, but just to show people how personal Trayvon's killing was. And I said, you know, when I was growing up, I was taught to never run in public, to never run in public with anything in my hands, you know, lest anyone think I stole something. And to always be aware of my surroundings, I had the rules. The reaction, people who read the piece, that was the one paragraph that they all pulled out as the piece of writing or the information that they never knew.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean is I'm talking about white people, but also black people pulled that out and started saying, yeah, I got the talk too.
Yep. Yep.
And that's how we all got started talking about the quote-unquote, the talk.
Well, yeah, and it became a thing on Morning Joe for I remember you and Eugene, myself, were sort of in that space around that time and subsequent on this subject. Hey, Jonathan, let's take a quick break right here so we can get a word in from our advertisers. They have a couple of things they'd like to share with our listeners. And when we're done with that, we'll come right back and have some more of this great conversation with Jonathan Capehart right after this.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to LostGolfBalls.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.
All right, folks, we're back, and we're talking with Jonathan Capehart of the Washington Post. So, Jonathan, we were talking about the talk, you know, the talk that every black parent has to have with their children, especially their young men. And it surprises me that the white community just was totally unaware that a black family had to go through this process.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have to. They didn't have to sit down, sit their kids down and talk to them. Well, when you encounter the police, okay,
right.
You know, their only response, well, if you get arrested, just call me. You know, there was no concern about, you know, I'll have to make sure your funeral arrangements are in order before you leave the house. You know, it's a very different dynamic for these two families, a white family and a black family. And it touched on, for me, it touches on, in the piece that you put out yesterday, a white damsel leveraged racial power and failed. Historically speaking, when white people are afraid, it is usually people of color who get hurt. So true. That's the what do you call that? Right under the headline. What are you?
Oh, the subhead.
Subhead, yeah.
Subhead.
It's,
and that was. And
it's
that
a
was
journalistic
written,
thing. I have a subhead.
Right. And that was written not by me, but by a woman named Ruby Hamid. And it was an op-ed in the New York Times yesterday that was really terrific.
So I want to pull a couple of pieces because I think your article here, and I, again, highly recommend it to folks if you don't. Follow Jonathan in the Post, do so, and certainly on Twitter at KpartJ. You start off talking about the symbolism is almost too much to bear. The antagonist stares down the barrel of the camera, removing her surgical face mask at the same moment she takes off her figurative mask and offers the audience a glimpse into what lies beneath. And then her words, I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life, she says, clutching her cell phone. The damsel in distress, you go on, the damsel in distress archetype probably conjures up images of delicate maidens and chivalrous gentlemen. That is precisely what it is designed to do for white people. And that, for me, goes into what we're just talking about. There's a different culture, there's a different experience, there's a different reality for white people than it is for black folks, which is why I opened up this segment with the question, what is it about black people that some white people have a hard time dealing with still today? What is that sort of mentality in your experience? And as you've covered these stories, what is behind that? Is it because it can't be, oh, I'm afraid of black people. And it can't be just relying on bullshit stereotypes that we know aren't true. I mean, you know, back in the days of Archie Bunker, yeah, you could probably get away with a lot of crap and everybody just kind of laugh and move on. Today, you know, folks lose their jobs or at least get in a lot of trouble for putting on blackface 30 years ago. So what is it that makes this culturally problematic for white folks?
Well, first, I want to say again, the words that you just quoted were not from me. They were from an author named Ruby Hammond, who wrote an op-ed in the New York Times.
I'm sorry, Ruby Hammond.
New York Times yesterday.
Right.
And she's the author of a book called White Tears, Brown Scars, How White Feminism Betrays Women of Color. And she has to answer your question, she's got another good line here, is that, but even, she quotes Amy Cooper saying that she's not a racist and did not mean to harm that man in any way. But Ruby goes on to write, but even here she betrays her sense of white superiority, even if she didn't intend to physically hurt him. She certainly was letting him know she had the power to do so and was attempting to corner him into submission. And what I would say is, and I think Michelle Norris, my colleague at the Post, in her column that just went out this morning, it's not that racism is perpetrated by individual actors. It is a system.
Right.
It is a system that people maneuver through or operate the levers of power on any given day, any minute. And what we saw with Amy Cooper is she might have considered herself I'm not a racist. But when push came to shove, as we saw in that video, she was willing to put the life of a black man in danger. For what purpose? I mean, trying to figure out.
That's the good question. What did she think she would achieve by doing that? Was that so much white privilege that she just figured the system would just land on her side and there would be no repercussions
But that is exactly it. That is exactly it, because that's the way the system has worked all these generations, all these decades. That is how the system has worked. An accusation from usually a white woman leads to horrific consequences for black men. Emmett Till.
Yes, Emmett Till. Yeah.
I mean, you just go back to that. He was accused of making a lewd comment to a white woman, a teenager, a young teenager. And he was kidnapped, tortured, murdered, so horribly disfigured that his mother had to decide whether to have an open casket or closed casket, but opted for an open casket to basically have her son's mauled, mutilated face be a mirror back to America.
Yeah.
And so when she says, I'm not a racist and I didn't mean to cause him harm, I would say that's bullshit,
yes,
whether you are conscious of it or not.
Right.
Which is why I've read so many pieces now, I can't remember who wrote what, but somebody wrote that threatening to call the cops on a black person, and a black man in particular, it does not conjure up scenes of comfort or safety. It is actually a threat to that person's life, simply because the presumption has been and will continue to be until we stop it. The presumption will be that the darker skinned person in a confrontation is the one who's at fault.
Right.
And you know what? And if you think this is hyperbole and that, you know, we're just blowing things out of proportion. Remember those protests in state capitals?
Yes.
Let's take Michigan.
Yes.
Where you had assault rifle toting mm-hmm. white men
mm-hmm.
storming the Capitol, threatening the life of the governor. And I don't know about you, but I don't recall seeing a massive police presence out there preventing them from doing that. Or trying to get them away, or hauling them off, or in riot gear. And yet for the last two nights, we have seen out of Minneapolis people who are protesting the killing of George Floyd being met by police, not only in riot gear, but being shot at with rubber projectiles and tear gas.
And then they wonder why there's, quote, violence, which you almost get the sense that that's what they're waiting for. They want that moment to occur. They want to, you know, stoke those embers enough that there's a spark that causes the whole thing to go up, so they can have these screaming headlines. See, there go black people rioting again. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't made that connection until you just made it, between, you know, white men with, you know, in stormtrooper gear with, you know, fully loaded ammunition and rifles and all kinds of stuff on their bodies going up to protest outside the state capitol over a requirement that they protect themselves in a national pandemic, you know, a health mm-hmm. pandemic. And, you know, black folks who are rightly upset about the execution of a young black man at the hands of police, and yet they are met with riot-geared police officers.
Here's another example, Michael. Okay, so now let's say it's a black person with a gun, and, you know, an assault, mm-hmm. assault rifle. What would happen to them? Well, we kind of have an example. John Crawford in Ohio. This was in 2014. He's in Walmart.
Oh, yes.
Shopping in Walmart. And where they sell, toy guns.
Toy guns, yeah.
And so, you know, he picks up the toy gun and he's walking around. And I think he's talking on the phone. Someone calls 911 on him. And the police kill him.
Kill him.
Because, yep. You know, I mean, that was probably like the first shopping while black incident. And so we have so many examples of the hypocrisy is not the right word, but I can't think of the word right now, but it's so simple I can't think of it. But the dichotomy between if a white person does it versus a black person does it, and the disparate reactions to what's happening. There's a sort of heart tugging in a bad way. Clip of a young man being interviewed in the middle of the protests in Minneapolis. I don't know if it was last night or the night before. And his voice starts out calm, and he says, you know, you have to understand where this is coming from. And I'm paraphrasing. You know, I wish they wouldn't do these sorts of things, and it shouldn't come to that. But, you know, we can't even look at the police as someone to protect us. And so when this happens over and over again, because Minneapolis has had many police-involved killings, when this happens over and over again and nothing happens to correct it, well, whose fault is that? That's on you. That's on the police. So why do you think we should, you know, not that we should obey you, but why should we look at you as someone to protect us?
Right.
And we're out here by ourselves. And that's why whenever there's a riot situation, I implore anyone who is listening, if there's ever a riot, look beyond the initial flashpoint. Because a riot never happens because one thing has happened. A riot is the culmination of many things.
It's absolutely. It's a culmination and a reflection of those things. It's like a cauldron. There's stuff in it that goes back generations that's been stewing and brewing. And that was my point from before. You know, why are white folks still surprised that black folks are upset when another member of their community is killed the way Mr. Floyd was killed, was confronted the way Mr. Cooper was confronted? why, you know, or literally watching video of a black man being hunted down as he was in the Aubrey case. And this boy sitting there, oh yeah, I just happened to drive by and I just caught it on camera. And, you know, yeah, brother, that's because you were filming this thing. So you got the three of y'all can grab a six pack and go back and watch it and relive the moment. So when black people are perceived as no better than animals that can be hunted and tracked down or summarily dismissed, who have no value in the moment, where you can just kind of threaten them with, look, I'm just going to call the police and tell them you're threatening me. I'm just going to make shit up and they're going to believe me, not you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, at some point, somebody's going to go to the street. At some point, that's going to find a release. It has to.
Right.
And it just does. You know, white folks get that release. Like you said before, they can go to the state capitol with, you know, armed to the teeth and they're not even going to send. They'll have the state troopers standing on the steps kind of looking at them and y'all behave yourselves. And that's about it. They're not met with riot gear. They're not met with police dogs. So we see the visual. I mean, not only do we have these, but we see how you respond in similar situations where it involves white folks and the outcome is different. And that's what the conversation, folks, is all about that we have with our boys. I told my boys, when you out with your white friends and y'all driving around D.C. and Maryland and Virginia, and y'all having a good old time, and the cops pull your ass over, know this, that of the four people in the car, one of whom is black and three of whom are white, the most dangerous person in that car to that police officer walking up to that car is you, brother.
Mm-hmm.
Trust me. Trust me on that. And you have to understand and put that in context. Now, do we want to have that conversation? No. Do we want our kids to be in fear of the police to the point that the young man that you referenced was making, you know, about the police, where you can't trust them and you fear them? No, that's not, because our mamas don't raise us that way. They still raise us despite everything to say, you know, obey the law and respect the police and da 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 da. But the mounting evidence, Jonathan, is to the contrary, that there is not a reason to trust. And that is the crux of it. And again, we have video evidence this week of why it's hard to do that. On that note, I want to thank my good friend Jonathan Capehart for what I thought was a very enlightening, important, and good discussion. Thanks, Jonathan. Really appreciate it. All right, folks, please visit us again for the next big episode. And you know what? It's going to be part two of a conversation with Jonathan Capehart. You want to check that one out as well. Don't forget to download us, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeart, wherever you get your podcast on. There's so many great places where you can follow along, give five-star love to the Michael Steele Podcast. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. lostgolfballs.com.